The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer here in the author events office, and I'm very excited to be here to introduce Chris Wilson. Convicted of murder at 18 and sentenced to life in prison with no hope of release, Chris Wilson began to improve himself through study, physical fitness, and he even started a business. For the next several years, he followed the tenets of his master plan, and in his mid-30s, he convinced a judge of his reformation and earned an early release. Since then, he has become a successful entrepreneur, public speaker, and mentor. Most notably, he is founder and owner of the Barclay Investment Corporation, a residential and commercial contracting business that connects unemployed Baltimore City residents with clients who need services. Wilson's other businesses include a high-end furniture restoration and design company and a social impact content development company. His new memoir is a tale of second chances titled The Master Plan, and it details the story of his incarceration, metamorphosis, and transcendence, while offering a fresh take on the American criminal justice system. It has garnered praise from Pulitzer Prize winner Taylor Branch, a variety of periodicals and trade reviews, and none other than Senator Bernie Sanders. Tonight's author will be joined in conversation with State Representative Jordan Harris of the 186th Legislative District located right here in Philadelphia. Recently elected to serve as Democratic Whip in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, Representative Harris previously served as chairman of the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus and also worked in Philly city government. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Chris Wilson and Jordan Harris to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
All right, good evening. How's everybody doing? All right, we're going to have some fun. We're going to have a really live interesting conversation. But first, let us again give Chris a round of applause for being here and sharing his story. So we're going to start off and just let Chris tell us a little bit about himself, the book, and give some insight, and then we'll start and have a little dialogue. And after the dialogue, then we'll open it up and have some questions. Chris?
How you guys doing? I love Philly. So I like to begin discussions with, particularly about this book, about talking about what it's really about. And so the goal of my book is I would like to raise the level of consciousness of people. It's not completely just about criminal justice. And so I just want to tell my story a little bit, kind of sum it up. So when I was young, I used to sleep on the floor at night. And I had a bed, but there was so much gun violence in my neighborhood, my grandmother wasn't taking any chances. And so I remember one night, I laid up on the floor, and I read this story, Plato's Allegory of the Cave. And in this story, imagine prisoners, mostly men, in a line facing a wall. And behind them, there's a fire to keep them warm, but it also casts shadows on the wall. So the guys make a daily game out of trying to identify lifelike characters within the shadows. Every day, this is what they would do. And they were okay with this. But one prisoner felt that there had to be more to his life than sitting shackled, eating disgusting food, and laughing at shadows. So this prisoner decides to starve himself in an attempt to slip out of his chains. 2 weeks later, 20 pounds lighter, he's able to slip out of his chains. He walks past the fire and up towards the exit of the cave. But the sunlight hits his eyes, and he turns away in agonizing pain because he had never seen the sun before. And so as he's thinking whether or not he should return to his chains or embrace this pain, he decides to embrace the pain, hopefully discovering a beautiful world if he made it out. So once he exits the cave, he's blinded by a magnificent light. He sees vibrant colors for the first time of his life. He sees trees bobbing back and forth. He hears water rushing from a nearby stream. He stares out further and he sees clouds and mountain ranges and birds, and it's so pretty and so beautiful that he begins to cry. How could all of this exist, he wonders. So while he's pondering this existential moment, a guard spots him. And the guard becomes angry, and the guard says, "What the hell are you doing outside of the cave?" And the prisoner begins to beg the guard, "Let me go, let me just stay out here. It's so beautiful. I get it now. Like, I can behave. Just let me stay out here." And the guard gets even angrier and says, "You have to go back down in the cave, because that's where you people belong, down in the cave, not out here with us." And so the prisoner is rechained and returned down to the bottom of the cave. And so when he's back down there, his friends mock him and tease him for trying to be different, for trying to buck the system. And another prisoner tells him, "You try to be different, and look at you. Your eyes don't work, and you back down here. Anyone else who tries to escape the cave, we're going to kill you. This is our cave. All we got is us." So then the story ends. And see, this story reminds me of the neighborhood that I grew up in, Washington, D.C. And around this time, we had a homicide rate of almost 500. And I remember asking my grandmother every night, who were we at war with? People were being killed for their tennis shoes. My grandmother would tell me, "Just don't worry about it, Chris. Just mind your business and go to school and everything will be okay." Then my brother was shot 7 times. Then my cousin was shot 17 times. Again, my grandmother would say, "Don't worry about it, Chris. Just go to school and everything will be okay." Then me and my mom was attacked by a police officer. He knocked me unconscious. And when I woke up, he was raping my mom. And again, my grandmother said, "It's going to be okay. Don't worry about it." And people in my neighborhood would tell me, "Chris, all we got is us." And then one night they came after me and I ended up taking a person's life. And as you can imagine, going to prison is like being teleported to another planet. Humiliating strip searches. No privacy. No girlfriends. And I remember sitting there depressed, staring out the window, thinking that my life was over. And I remember around this time, people came after my family and killed my father. And so I knew in my heart that I was a good person and that I can change. And so I decided to come up with a master plan, not an escape plan. And in this plan, I wanted to get my high school diploma, a college degree. I wanted to learn Spanish. I wanted a Corvette. But most importantly, I wanted to be free again. I wanted to be free to return to impoverished communities and be an example and show people a way out of the figurative cave. So every day, all I did was study, exercise, and go to therapy. But the prison officials would tell me, "Chris, life means life. Your place is in here, not out there in the real world." Well, I read hundreds of books. I got my high school diploma. I got my college degree. I taught myself to read and write in Spanish and Italian and went on to learn Mandarin. 10 years had went by and I hadn't wasted a day. And I remember guys in the prison who I mentored would say, "I don't understand why you can't get a second chance. We see people come out, they go back, they come out, and they come back, but you can't get a second chance." And he says, "I never hear you talk about God." And he says, "Maybe that's what's missing in your life." Now, I believed in God. I just didn't understand him or her. What did my mom do to deserve to be attacked? Why did so many stray bullets take people away from my neighborhood? Why do people treat me different just because of the color of my skin? So I remember reading my master plan and praying to God for a sign. 2 weeks later, my lawyer comes to see me and he says, "I don't know what happened, but the judge wants to see you. She changed her mind." And so I stood before the judge and I talked to the judge about what it felt like as a young man to watch my friends gunned down in front of me. What it felt like to watch my mom be violated by a police officer, someone who was supposed to protect us. Then I talked about how remorseful I was for what I'd done, how much I educated myself and what I would do if she gave me a second chance. And I remember she just stared at me, and I could hear my heart beating. I could feel it beating like through my shirt. And she says, "I'm going to give you a second chance." She says, "But you can't be regular. You can't just get out and get a job and fly under the radar. You put some really ambitious stuff in this on your plan. And so you got to do everything. You want to start a business. You want to write a book. You want to travel around the world. You got to do it all. And you better not disappoint me." I ended up serving 16 years in prison. I finally made it home with $50 in my pocket. I was homeless. I had no job. And I remember my mom called me, and she was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe you out. Like, what happened, Chris? Like, did you break out? I thought you had life." And I was like, "Mom, I worked my plan. I'm back in school, and it's going to be okay." And then my mom started acting funny. She was like, "I need you to remember some stuff. I need you to remember that I love you, and I want you to finish your plan. I love you, Chris." And I was like, "Why are you talking like this? Like, you like relax, you're on speakerphone." And she was like, "Just don't forget." And when she hung the phone up, she wrote a letter and committed suicide. So my mom never even had a chance to see me as a free man. But if she was out in the audience today, I would tell my mom, "I've been out of prison for 7 years. I'm the owner of 2 successful multi-million dollar companies in Baltimore City that provide jobs to people who need help the most." I would tell my mom how I went from feeling invisible to winning every award in the state of Maryland, including a presidential award from Obama. I would tell my mom that I'm 1 semester away from earning my 2nd college degree. I would tell my mom how when I was young and I always wanted that Corvette, well, I worked really hard and I bought one. I would tell my mom, or maybe I would just tell her that I loved her one more time. Thank you.
All right. I feel like I should be like my pastor and say, "Okay, thank you, God bless, and good night." So, Chris, let's go back. You talked a lot about your mom and your grandmother, yeah. But let's go back to the beginning, before your the crime, before the incarceration.
Right.
Tell us who Chris was at 6, 7 years old, and what did you want to do? What did you want to become? And you know, all of those things that you ask a first or second grader in school.
Well, growing up, I mean, surprisingly, I wanted to be a police officer. Like, I wanted to be someone that just, like, helped people. I remember the police officers used to come to the school, officer friendly, and they just seemed cool back then. And police officers would come through the neighborhood. They knew who everyone was. And I just, as I got older, I just learned that wasn't the case.
And what happened? What was that trend? When was that transition for you?
So I think it was, like, during the time, the late 80s, when crack started sweeping our neighborhoods, mm-hmm. Late 80s, early 90s, and we would only see police officers come through just to like bang down doors. They started like driving like 6-wheel vehicles and just like jumping out and like harassing us. And so like we would see them and we would just run. And so I no longer wanted to be a police officer.
And who was in your house with you?
So I stayed, my mom worked as a paramedic. And she worked long shifts, so I stayed with my grandmother Monday through Friday, and I would stay with my mom on the weekends.
Any siblings?
So I had siblings. I had a sister, older sister, and 2 older brothers. And I wasn't ever really into sports. I think I ran track, but I was like kind of like forced to run track. And so my passion was going to the library. And I would get in trouble because it was a 4-lane library, and I would cross the street and you know, my grandmother would put me on punishment or give me a beating, actually. Just being honest.
Oh, no, listen, I got lots of beatings. Yeah. I remember one time my grandmother threw her slipper across the room, and I thought she could have been on any baseball team because the way she hit me in the head with her slipper. You had a grandma like that?
Absolutely, yeah.
I think all black children have a grandma who can take that slipper and just fling it across the room.
Yeah, that was definitely my grandma.
All right. So in school, what was your school life like?
So I loved school, but I wasn't really a good student. So mm-hmm. I was a very good reader. I actually skipped a grade, I believe, because I could read really well. But, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, there was so much violence that started happening in the 80s, in the early 90s. I couldn't concentrate.
Explain it. What does that mean?
It means, like, I used to sleep on the floor because during the crack epidemic, folks would have machine guns and the bullets would literally go through our house. And so my grandmother would make us sleep on the floor or in the tub. And people started dying all the time. Every couple of months, we had to go to a funeral, or stray bullets would just like hit like my neighbors or anyone. And so how could I concentrate in school when I was thinking about what I had saw the day before? And so I was traumatized.
Now, you said you had a sibling
who
lost their life to gun violence, correct?
So my brother got shot, but he survived. Okay. My cousin died, and this happened in front of the house.
Now, were you there when it happened?
I didn't see it, but I was close.
Okay, so your mother was a paramedic, grandmother was there also in the house with you, but you said you love to spend time in the library. So how explain the transition from doing that to being in a situation that got you to the crime?
So around this time when the gun violence started sweeping through D.C., my mom tried something different and said, well, it's not really safe for him, so maybe he should move out of D.C. and stay with me in Maryland. But my mom started dating a police officer, and this police officer turned out to be a crooked cop. I mean, think like Denzel in Training Day, like real like charismatic, but just like a bad person, setting people up, and he would beat my mom. And so I went from one bad situation to another one. So around this time, things just got worse. And even with the assault with my mom, I felt helpless because I couldn't help my mom. And I fell into a depression and things that I wanted to do, like I was on a chess team, I was playing the cello.
And people, you were playing the cello?
Yeah, I was playing the cello like around this time. So I think it was like sixth grade, seventh grade.
So did you take the cello to school? Or they had it already there for you.
They had it there already.
I'm about to say, because that had to be hard walking through the hood with a cello.
Yeah. I can't walk through the hood. Yeah.
I don't think you could just get away with walking through the hood with a cello. Is that a big guitar? Right. What you got going on? All right, go ahead.
Well, that was the thing. So eventually, people in the neighborhood found out about it, including my brothers, and they was like, "That's lame. Mm-hmm. You didn't play the cello."
So I'm gonna tell you a secret. Yeah. I played the violin at elementary school.
Nice.
And I stopped playing it because everybody kept telling me it was lame. Thing. I was just like, I play the guitar now. Right. So I had to make something up. But go ahead.
So that was the case. And so I wasn't into sports. So what was I supposed to do?
Right.
And so I would read books. But like it was just so much violence in my house, in the neighborhood. And at a certain point, like after... you know, so many people started getting shot, I just started carrying a gun just for protection.
So wait, so let's dig deeper into that, because I think a lot of times, you know, when you look at the media and they talk about young people carrying guns, it's always made out to be, you know, like the young person is this, you know, big bad person.
Right.
So what was your reasoning, again, for carrying a gun?
So I mean, it was simple. Like, someone would get shot in our neighborhood, and we would call the police, and they wouldn't come. Or they would come 45 minutes later, and it's like, the bad guys are gone already.
Right.
And, you know, I just would carry a gun for protection. Like, and I had no intention on actually using it. Like, I was terrified to use it, but, you know, I would kind of like, I wanted people to know I had it so they wouldn't bother me.
Where'd you get the gun from?
I just bought it from someone on the street. Like, everyone had guns.
Wow.
I mean, unfortunately, it's still like that.
So the cello playing library guy now is carrying a gun.
Yep.
That you got on the street.
Yep.
Now, how much you pay for it? You remember?
Like $200.
Where'd you get $200 from? You got $200 from playing the cello?
Nah, I think I probably, I don't know. I can't even remember where I got the money from.
All right.
Maybe I traded something for it.
So library... You're still living with your mom now, right?
Yep.
Who's dating the police officer.
Yep.
Plays the cello, goes to the library, you know, and now you pick up a gun and you start to carry a gun. Now, had you ever shot a gun when you actually bought the gun?
I did shoot it, I think, once.
Once, okay. And now fast forward that to the night of the incident.
So at this point, I've been shot at a couple times. I lost more friends. The police officer had sexually assaulted my mom. Because he was a police officer, he only done 18 months in prison. He got out, and he started stalking our family. So around this time, there was no law against stalking. And so, like, if he's sitting in front of our house or, like, calling us, there was nothing we can do. And so, you know, my brothers, we all started carrying guns then. And I remember...
And how old were you when you first...
I was, like, 13, 14,
okay.
Like, around this time. And I kept thinking about the incident, like, what happened to my mom and me being, like, you know, helpless. And then I get kidnapped. Like, I'm carrying a gun, I'm in front of the house, and then I see a car pull up, and I think it's, like, my friends, and I wave, and they roll up, and they just, it was, like, mistaken identity. They thought it was someone else. And so they kidnapped me. I talk about it in the book. They kidnapped me, and they take me, like, to this vacant house, and, like, they're talking about where they're going to dump my body, like, in a river or, like, wrap me up, and I can hear them, right? And I'm so scared. You know how the movies, like, people play like they're tough? I was terrified, and I was shaking so much, I just used the bathroom on myself. And then eventually they realized I was the wrong person. And so they let me go. And they was like, it's just business. Like, don't take it personal, right?
Yeah, it's natural, right? You know, get kidnapped, it's just business. Oh, okay.
And so I get home and I'm smelling like, you know, urine and stuff. And, you know, my brothers and my friends, they laugh at me. And they was like, how you let yourself get kidnapped when you had a gun on you? And it was like, it wasn't in me. I wasn't like... trying to, you know, I wasn't in me like to kill someone or shoot at someone really. And so around this time, I remember at that moment that I was like, I keep hesitating. I keep losing friends. I couldn't help my mom.
Right.
And I was like, the next person, I'm not going to hesitate again. And so this night I was walking to the store and these men just turned the corner, like grown men. And they started following me. And I was like, I knew they didn't live in my neighborhood. And so I was like, let me go up here by this store where there's a lot of light and there's a lot of people. And like, they can't do nothing to me then. I had a gun on me, but again, like, it was like, I don't want to use it. And so I went up to the store where it was light and they surrounded me. And they was like, are you Chris? And I was like, who are y'all? And they was like, we've been watching you. Don't think for a moment. We can't do something to you. And then the other guy was trying to get behind me and I just started shooting. And then they ran one way and I ran another way. And I found out later that I took a person's life.
So when you found out, well, first of all, when you pulled the trigger, what was going through your head when it happened? Or was anything going through your head?
I mean, I was just thinking about, I just ain't want to die. And it's like, I had been to so many funerals. I just was like, I just didn't want it to be me. I haven't done anything with my life. And it's like, I'm not trying to die. And I was 17 when this happened.
So when you found out that a person had died from this gunshot, what were you thinking?
I mean, I didn't believe it at first because when I fired my gun, both of the guys just ran away. And then I ran the other way. I was like, how could I possibly hit him? Like, he ran away. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't believe it at first. And then I just was, you know, I just was like, I'm probably gone for the rest of my life. This is it. Mm-hmm. And I could have talked about it. And even like in the street, they like, don't talk to the police, don't say anything. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really say anything. I could have told them like what happened. Mm-hmm. I just didn't say anything. It was like it wasn't me.
And now tell us about the arrest. How did you get arrested? What happened?
So, they come kick your door down and all that stuff and search the house.
Like on training day?
Yeah, like on training day.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
And I just remember my mom just being disappointed. Like, what have you done? Like, what have you done? And, you know, things just got worse. Like, my mom financed the house to try to, like, you know, get me a lawyer.
Right. Yeah,
and she lost the house.
Wow.
My dad had just got killed at this point. And so my dad had left us the house and all that. So my mom moved into that house. She lost that house. And because of, like, the injuries to her, she got addicted to the pain pills. They overprescribed her, like they still do today. And she fell into a depression. She couldn't work after that. And she just spiraled downhill to, like, heroin and, like, everything. And it just was a mess. And as this was around a time where I got sentenced, and they was like, you know, we sentenced you to natural life in prison.
And what did you, like, because, you know, you watch TV all the time, and you see the, you know, sometimes you see, you know, people kind of, you know, fall out and all. Like, what was, you know.
I fainted in the cell. Like, I you know.
So you were strong in the courtroom.
Yeah, I didn't believe it. Like it didn't make sense.
And okay.
Like, but, like, how are you going to sentence me for the rest of my life?
And you were 17.
By the time I got sentenced, I was 18.
Okay.
And I just went to my cell and I cried. And then because I had life, they put me in solitary confinement for a while. Because they felt like I would be a danger to someone or or myself.
So I've been to a lot of the state facilities here in Pennsylvania, probably about 10 of them. I go into the cells, I talk to inmates, and if you've never been inside a prison, I don't think people really get it, because, you know, movies and TV don't do it justice. Tell us about a day in prison.
I mean, I could say about the first day. I mean, walking in, one, I was 120 pounds, like, going into prison. And so, like, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to defend myself. And so I literally was shaking, like, the whole time. You know, you got to sign in, like, inmate, what's your name? And, like, I'm signing stuff, and I just was shaking, because I was just like, soon as someone says something to me, I'm going to have to jump on them. Or, like, you know, I don't know what prison's like, right? And then we go in, and it's, you know, it's like 10 of us, and they just strip us naked, all of us. And it was just humiliating. I was like, can we go back in the room? I said, no, there's no privacy in here. And they stripped us.
Wow.
And then they made us all, like, drop and squat and then bend over and, like, spread them. And it was like, don't move your position until we tell you to. And then they laughed at us. That was my first day.
Now, a lot of times people talk about the first night. Did you sleep?
No, I couldn't sleep. No, I couldn't sleep.
Okay.
Like, you know, I was nervous. And then it was, like, crazy. It's exactly what you expected, like music blasting. I mean, I described my first day in there, right? And it's like music blasting. COs like, turn it down. They ignore the COs. And it's like people who have been lifting weights for 30, 40 years, like 7 feet tall, right?
And you're 120 pounds.
120 pounds.
I got you. Okay.
And so it was terrifying.
Right. Now fast forward that. So, okay, the master plan, like, what? You know, there's a lot of times people talk about their time in prison, and there's like a rock bottom, you know, a moment where you get to rock bottom before you get to
bottom.
So explain, what was your rock bottom? Where'd you get there before you got to the master plan?
So I remember around this time, I just got in, maybe I've been a couple of days, and I just was like trying to call home. I was calling my mom, like, you know, like, I was like, it's rough in here. Like I don't know what I'm going to do. And she was like, you know, you should have thought about that, you know, before you did what you did. And then she says, didn't accept one call, and then she finally called. And I was like, why are you not accepting the calls? And she was like, what's the point? You got life. You never coming home. And so, and then, you know, my girlfriend stopped accepting the calls. People stopped coming to visit me. And it was like I felt like I was dead. I didn't even have a mustache on my face. And I remember sitting there and just like staring out the window. And it was like I knew like that I had potential. I knew that I could read well. I knew like that I was a good person. And I was like, I'm not going out like this. I don't want to be remembered as a person who took a person's life. And so I remember locking myself in my cell for a couple of days. And I just was thinking about, like, who is the person that I want to become? What is it that I always wanted to be? And I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. My mom, like, taught me entrepreneurship when I was young, and, like, selling blow pops and, like, you know, overhead and profit margins and stuff like that. And I was like, that's who I always wanted to be. And I call it in a book a positive delusion. I was like, I'm right now, I'm just going to choose to believe that I'm going to get out one day. And I was like, so what's my end game? I was like, I want to get out. I'm going to build a business empire. But I was like, I also want to be like a good person and go back into the communities and create opportunities for people. Because like growing up, my uncle would say, and other people in the neighborhood was like, you need to get a job, or you need to like cut some grass and do stuff. But no one ever, he never like sat down and said, listen, let me show you like how to run a business. Let me show you how to do this. Like no one was doing this. So I said, I want to become that person.
But why? Like, again, you, like you've said several times, you were sentenced to life in prison.
Right.
Like, what, why? What's
I mean,
the
I'm
point?
Just being stubborn, I guess. And okay. So, like, you know, being delusional, right, in a positive way. But I had to believe that because working backwards from that, I said, like, if I'm going to be an entrepreneur, there's things I need to learn. I don't have my high school diploma, so I need that. I need a college degree. I need to start studying. And I was like, I'm 120 pounds, so I need to put some muscles on, so I need to start working out. And some of the stuff was like silly. It was like, I want to be able to try lasagna again and like, you know, all kinds of stuff, right? It was like celebrities I wanted to meet and stuff that I wrote on the list. And
what was the food that you missed the most?
Like lasagna. Home-cooked lasagna. Yeah.
Home-cooked
lasagna and shrimp. Yeah.
See, I'm from Philly, so it'd probably been like a cheesesteak.
Cheesesteak, yeah.
I done had too many of those. I could go without for a little while.
Yeah.
A little while,
yeah.
Don't y'all get carried away. Y'all laughed a little too hard on that one. All right. So you were stubborn.
And I
appreciate it.
And I'm still like that, yeah.
That's
but in a positive way. Yeah.
Now, did you have an old head in prison?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So there was a couple old heads in prison. They also were serving life. All of them actually were serving life. And some of them at first was like, you know, young blood, you know, just get comfortable. Because like when you get life, you know, you're not getting out. And these people had been locked up 30, 40 years. And I just remember them like schooling me to like the rules of prison and just like, you know, don't stare into anyone's cell and like mind your business and all this stuff, right? And I journal every day. I've been journaling all my life. I still do it. And I would just journal and like document like the rules and like stuff that I learned, notes from books that I read, and was just learning how to like mentally like navigate prison. And like, I think the first thing on my master plan was to stop calling home. And it's like one of those, you just forget about home. I actually forgot about the outside world. And like rap videos or something like would come on TV, I wouldn't even look at it because I didn't even want to think about women or anything, cars and stuff. I just focused on my studies. And then I started going to therapy, but I didn't talk in therapy for like 2 years. And then eventually like I opened up. And that was when I like had a very deep like transformation.
So, you know, when I go, there are a lot of organizations in prison.
Right.
Which I was shocked to see. Like, I know several prisons in Pennsylvania, we have like NAACP chapters, there's lifers organizations and groups, and they're really organized. They have, you know, officers of the organizations, and it seems somewhat like kind of like organized chaos inside of a prison. So there's chaos, but it's still some type of organization. Did you latch on to anything like that inside?
Not at first. So because of like what I went through, I felt like I was the only one who'd been through like that much gun violence, all that stuff, witnessed like all, you know, assaults, you know, on my mom and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so painful for me. I just bottled it up and didn't want to talk about it. And so only until I was, because in the prison I was at, you had to go to therapy, you had to go to school in order like to be there. It was like programming. And so I remember taking a group. It was victim impact group where victims of crimes come into the prison and you sit in a room and y'all have therapy together. And they give you their side of it. And to be honest with you, this was at this point, I've been in like 6 years. I'm going to just be honest with you. I wasn't remorseful for what I'd done up until that moment, 6 years. Because like, again, in my mind, I was like, I didn't start it. These people came after me. Like he got himself killed. I didn't kill him.
Mm.
And it's like, so I didn't feel it. Right. And so this lady, in this group, and this, you know, this African-American lady, she sat down and she was talking about how her car had got stolen or like stolen and damaged. And I was like, you got insurance, right? And she was like, but I had to pay like a deductible and I didn't have the money. And I was like, why did you have to pay? What's a deductible? Why you had to pay that? She was like, that's how it is. Like, and so I suffered either way without a car. And then she pulled out a picture of her daughter and she says, what you think about her? What she look like? And I was like, she's cute. She passed it around to some other guys in the group, and they was like, yeah, your daughter's cute. What's her name and stuff, right? And she says, two guys thought she was cute too. And they grabbed her coming home from school, and then they took her in the woods and they raped her. And then they took a knife and they stabbed her like 40 times. And then they chopped her body up and set her on fire. And then she looked at us and she said, these guys were monsters, just like you guys. And so I remember like her saying this, and while she was talking, I was feeling it, right? And I was like, I know I took a person's life, but I'm not a monster. I could never do that to someone. And I felt bad that she thought I was a monster. And it made me think about like victims, that's how they look at us, especially like prisoners, right? And then so I kept thinking about this, and then I go back to my tear. And then guys who were in my group were laughing. They was like, I would have done the same thing. And so I was like, some of these guys are monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I gotta open up in group. I gotta start working harder to prove to myself and everyone else that I'm not a monster. And that was when the moment when I was like, I started feeling stuff, compassion. And I still feel it to this day. Like, I get upset, like, you know, something happened on the news, like, I get upset. I'm out there, like, I'm showing up.
So, first of all, that was deep. Like, I, you know, that was just deep. I don't even know how to how to think. Because you know, I feel you on that. Like, I've never done anything, but, like, I get it. Like, there's, you know, to have that moment where it's like, those guys, they're savages.
Yeah.
Me, I'm not a savage. You know,
right.
I'm a kind of a, I would say, a victim of the situation.
Right.
Right. And for those guys to be like that, that kind of shows the difference. And the reason why I bring that up is because a lot of times when we talk about criminal justice reform and whatnot, people do look at certain folks and they just throw them away. Like, they're all savages. They're all monsters.
Because on paper, we got the same charge.
Right. But it's not the same situation.
Right.
Right. So, okay, so let's talk about the master plan. Like, what is the master plan for you?
Right.
What was it? So, how did it come about, all of that?
So earlier when I spoke, I said, like, my goal is to raise the level of consciousness of people. And so at a certain point in my, like, you know, this group, and then this group with a lady, and then going to school and started learning about the world and, like, the civil rights movement, and started, I was in college and being pushed. And, you know, some people say, like, you wake up. And then I got upset. Like, I learned about, like, the prison industrial complex and, like, how it decimated, like, my community, like, commissary prices and phone calls, everything was expensive. And I was like, they have turned this into a business. Mm-hmm. And I was like, slavery didn't disappear, it just metamorphosized itself into something different, and it's still, like, decimating our communities, right? And so I got upset. And so, like, my philosophy, and I started mentoring guys, and I was like, we need to be sharp. Yeah, I know, like, they profile us in the communities or whatever, we gotta just be smarter. We can't have, like, knives on us, we get pulled over, we gotta put wallet, registration, stuff on the dashboard, hands where you can see them. Like, we just gotta really step our game up, and we gotta educate ourselves. And so what the master plan was about educating myself. It was about getting out of prison. It was about starting a business empire, going back to these same tough neighborhoods and leading my men and women out of the figurative cave. And not living like a monk. Like, I live in a nice house now. I drive nice cars. And I want not even people just affected by the criminal justice system. Like, anyone. I want people to live their best lives. And I wanted to tell my story so that people can see someone who's came from all of that and has made it.
So that's great, right? That's wonderful. You've done all that. But what do you still say to the people who just aren't sold? Because I go to Harrisburg, and there's a contingency of folks when we're trying to get criminal justice reform bills passed that just believe that when a person commits a crime, that's it.
Right.
You know, and that they should be, you know, just discarded from our society, locked up, and then that's it. What would you say to a person to help educate them, help change their mind, if possible? Because some people ain't gonna never change their mind. But what would you do, like, in your mind?
Would this be, like, someone in, like, legislation, or just someone that's just, like,
If I took you to Harrisburg next weekend, you're standing in front of one of my colleagues, and we're about to take a vote on, we're doing a bill right now about the possibility of parole for those given life sentences. What would you say to that person?
So, I mean, for one, I would tell my story to them, right? I would tell them my story, but also I would tell them, like, I mean, the work that I've done since I've been out 7 years. I've been to Compton, Southside, Chicago, like, everywhere, and other places all around the world where people say, like, folks are, like, savages, and I've gotten people to put their guns down. Let's just take Baltimore, for example. I've helped, to date, 272 people in Baltimore in some of the toughest neighborhoods get jobs, and less than 10 of those jobs is minimum wages. And so, like, to the person who I would be talking to, like, I'm an example of it. Like, my life, I got every reason to be messed up, but I'm not. So, like, I'm the evidence, like, that we can turn our lives around. And then the other thing, too, like, I was a child when I made that decision. I don't think the way I used to think. And we're taking children who make a decision and we lock them away for the rest of our lives. What does that say about us as a people? Like, that's cruel.
You know, one of the things I always say is that none of us should be judged by our worst days.
Right.
And it's clear that that night when those gentlemen surrounded you, that was your worst day.
Yep.
And you should definitely not be judged by that. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a hand to Chris Wilson. So we have some time for some audience questions.
What became of your grandmother? Is she still alive and able to see what a wonderful metamorphosis has occurred with you?
Yeah, she's still alive. Yeah. It's interesting because she's like 92 right now, and
wow,
and making the book, you know, we had to interview her and stuff, and she didn't really believe all the stuff that I had done. You know, my accomplishments since I've been home, she couldn't believe it. It was like, nah, he was a bad little kid, right? but, you know, she saw me Tuesday. I was on the Today Show. And so I started my book career, my book launch on there. And so she saw that. And so it was like, you know, I ain't get on there for nothing, Grandma.
Yeah. I'm a retired correction officer. I did the system for 18 years.
Okay.
And I just retired about 10 years ago. And what changed my life is when I thought I was better than the people I was watching, because I was making this big money. And then God touched me and made me think, realize that you could have been in the same situation, because right. You wanted to kill a man was stealing something from you.
Yeah.
And I'm in the process now. I have a program called Breaking Chains. I'm a nonprofit organization. And I'm also working on putting a manufacturing program together for
nice.
A trade school. So I would definitely like to get with you.
Nice, okay.
I appreciate that.
Congrats, man.
So there's a lot of movement in the city for getting juvenile lifers released.
Yes.
And I pose it to both of you as a legislator, then someone who was inside. I know you expressed about how you were impacted by the conversation with the lady who was from Victims.
Right.
And so my question is, how important do you think it is for people to get an understanding of the victims' advocacy part of it to then be able to transform how other people are feeling about the release of juvenile lifers?
I think it's critical. It's very important because you gotta think about it, right? A lot of our young guys out smoking, drinking, listening to music, they kind of like numb to like the reality. And even like, you know, be honest with you, like even like shooting, like they close the eyes and fire a whole bunch of shots, probably hit like the wrong person and they run the other way. They don't know what it really like looks like. They don't know, like, I mean, to sit down and talk to like a victim. I mean, like, at least for me, like it touched me. Like, you know, guys need to like really like grasp like the impact of like what they do. But again, like that's tough. It's tough for like a juvenile to really like process that. Like their brain isn't even developed yet. Like how do they like really, really know what they're doing?
So I've spent a lot of time, to answer your question as well, because I spent a lot of time in prisons with those juvenile lifers. Actually, it's one brother got out, his name was Ghani. He did a long, long time in prison. I used to see him all the time up in Gratisford. And, you know, he talked about the victim piece, but, you know, he really opened my eyes to the thought that, you know, I was a child when I did my crime. And I had to think back to myself, what was I thinking at 16 and 17 years old? And I'm 34 now. So if you judge me on what I did when I was 16, it's just going to be over. Because, I mean, your mind's not even there. And it's not an excuse, right? It's not an excuse. Because, yes, there's a knowledge of right and wrong, but there's a depth in wrong. Like, how wrong are we talking about? You know, like, the understanding that someone will not return from this trigger that you're pushing. I'm not necessarily sure a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old gets that, right? So it's important that, you know, we don't let 16-year-old votes for a reason. We won't let you get married at 15, 16, for a reason. We won't let you drink at 16 for a reason, yet we want to hold you to an adult standard.
Right.
Right? So that has to be a part of the calculus as well. Young lady right here.
My brother had his hand up for a long time, too, right?
Guy, yep.
Good evening. I'm so nice. I'm so happy to meet you. Great book.
Thank you.
I am just emerging from a prison of the mind and the body myself. And at 16, I'm just learning some things about myself at 40.
Right.
I've made a lot of mistakes. Maybe they weren't even mistakes. I believe some people's steps are ordered upon their arrival here, and we're bred as champions in the womb. But I've lived out my life. You know, I'm trying to share some trauma. I'm writing myself. The change is evident in your behavior. People can see a change in you. It might take, you know, your grandmother fighting with my family now. Yeah. That's the struggle. I had therapy today, and right. I'm like, get yourself together, my mentor. You know right. where you're going tonight.
Right.
But the change is seen from others. Miraculous change in a very, very short period of time. I could relate to you, brother. That's why I hit you when you was riding. I said, yeah, I needed to see that to yeah. know that there's life after trauma. Yeah. I hope I could talk to you afterwards. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, sister.
All right, I got time for one more question. I'm getting a signal in the back. Now, there's a brother right here.
Yeah, he's very patient.
He's been waiting the whole time. And he's real tall, and I don't want to get in trouble when I leave. So,
good evening. My name is Brother Tracy Charles Gibson, and I wanted to thank you for giving this presentation. But I wanted to ask you, what country in Africa would you be willing to be king of if you could?
Thank you.
All right, pick one. Brother, ask questions.
I don't know.
Have you been to Africa?
I've been to Morocco.
Okay.
Morocco, that counts, yeah.
Yes, that's on the continent.
I don't know. There's like 46 countries in Africa. I don't know. I'd probably pick South Africa.
When you created your master plan when you was in the system, did any of the people who were in there with you started following the plan along with you?
That's a good question.
Absolutely. A whole bunch of people that's still doing it. And that's one of the things I want my book to do. One of my goals is to get my book into every prison in America. So it's 3,000 prisons. And so I'm working with a whole bunch of people to make that happen, including the Gates Foundation, Emerson Collective, a whole bunch of influential people. So I'm trying to do that.
Hi, I really just want to say thank you. You are an inspiration. You're speaking in the city that has more juvenile lifers
yes.
than any place in the world. If we were a state,
wow.
we would have more juvenile lifers than every state except Michigan. Over 300, and many of our juvenile lifers have started to get out, some equally remarkable and in many different ways, like you. We have over 100, and I think it's now up to 158 of our 313 have been released, and no one has gone back.
Awesome.
Absolutely. All right. So let me say this. So if this is really an issue that you really feel passionate about, I would implore all of you to get involved. I would implore all of you to call your state representative, your state senator, particularly if you live in the state of Pennsylvania, and let them know how you feel about this. Far too often, our elected officials get to rest on a tough-on-crime perspective on criminal justice. And typically what tough-on-crime means is just locking people up.
Yep.
And what we know is that that doesn't work. It hasn't worked. And we know that it costs us billions of dollars. There are many men and women in our jails and our prisons today that could be home. And 90% of them are coming home. The question is, what are they coming home to? And that's where all of us have a responsibility. And we all can get involved and stay informed and share our perspective with our legislators that we don't want to be tough on crime. We want to be smart on crime.
Right.
And smart on crime starts with reforming an unjust justice system that has been this way for far too long, particularly here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And with that, let's give Chris another hand. Let's say thank you to the library for hosting us. Thank you all for coming. Good night. God bless.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.